listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, speaking with us from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, let's see. It looks like the games have, I won't say they've begun. They began at least in April of 2002, but they're certainly still underway with Bolton and that whole crew that Trump has running foreign policy. 23 arrests, an attempted mutiny, trying to steal weapons out of an armory. It sounds almost like what happened in Benghazi when they took Libya. Quashed, however, the legacy of Hugo Chavez's deep relationship with the Venezuelan military and the Venezuelan military's deep involvement in the Bolivarian Revolution.
Yeah, and in Venezuela, there's a civic-military alliance that has been the kind of bedrock of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela ever since Hugo Chavez took office, really. And he steadily consolidated that in the years prior to his untimely death. And the armed forces in Venezuela are rock solid loyal to Nicolas Maduro. Yeah. The event of the last few days of this very small group of I'm not sure if they were full time military or if they were National Guard style people, but they it was very amateur their attempt. I mean, maybe surprisingly, maybe not, but they had no clear plan, although it was very carefully coordinated with people operating in the social media, and there was an attempt to kind of between the social media and opposition news media, the kind of newspapers, radios, TV, that kind of stuff. And there was an attempt to mount this impression that there was a very serious mutiny, and a widespread mutiny in the Venezuelan armed forces. But it was, in effect, it was very similar to last year's attempt by another very small group of people formerly in the armed forces and the police to steal arms and try and encourage other people to join them. But it completely failed. And that attempt failed in 2017. And this attempt this year has also completely failed. Now that the significance of this latest incident is that it does indicate that the United States authorities and their local allies in Venezuela and their backers in countries like Colombia in particular, but also other countries, which you can look at perhaps a bit further on, they are determined to continue mounting these stunts, these theatrical stunts, and in the hope that they will be able to build up enough opinion to sway, in particular, important elements of Venezuela's armed forces. That hasn't happened yet, and it's unlikely to happen in the near future. But who knows what might happen over a year, 2 years, especially if the government's economic measures in defense of the majority of people's standard of living don't have the effect that they hope for. So, and it's the same. It's nothing's changed. It's the same combination of the economic war and then these periodic quasi theatrical stunts that actually can have very serious consequences for the people that are on the receiving end of them. But the idea is that eventually the accumulated effect of the economic warfare and these kind of theatrical incidents, plus international pressure, with the United States now saying that, and I think Mike Pence today announced right. That he for the United States government, the only legitimate authority in Venezuela is the Venezuelan legislature, which has been operating illegally for I don't know how long it is now, for
2015 2015 election, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and just the other day, the Venezuelan Supreme Court reiterated that all the actions of the Venezuelan legislature are illegal until they recognize the judgment of the Supreme Court in relation to three deputies who have no right to sit in the legislature.
You know, so I just want to point out that just because the Constitutional Court or the Supreme Court said so, just because the constitutional order that the OAS seems to want to stand upon requires that people acknowledge these pronouncements as the law of the land, the supreme law of the land, I don't want to go there yet, but I'll point out that when they yanked Gbagbo out of the presidential palace in Cote d'Ivoire back in 2010, he had been anointed as the winner of the presidential election by the very same kind of authorities, by the constitutional court there, ignored.
That judgment was overridden by the United Nations and supported by French military.
Exactly now, right. So that's the same thing. So the setup here, I just want to get to this part, because I'm looking at Telesur's website now, and according to Jorge Rodriguez, the communications minister for the Venezuelan government, there were these weapons seized. 51 of them were stolen in the assault on Monday. 11 of them remain in the hands of the assailants. And he said apparently the purpose of this is that on tomorrow, on Wednesday the 23rd, There's an opposition march to the presidential palace is planned, or an opposition march is planned, and that they believe that what they intend to do is to use these weapons to cause violence that will produce a response from the government that will then be used as a reason for intervention. That seems like that's the play that may have been interrupted and may still be in play.
Yeah, and what's likely to happen if that's the case is that these weapons will be used to kill opposition supporters.
Right.
That will then be blamed on the government, which right. has been the standard modus operandi, I mean, for everywhere in all these recent U.S. interventions over the last 10 years or so.
But, well, some of those refer to that kind of a situation as the silver lining in the cloud. But that being said, you know, at least they're going to shoot a couple of those clowns to make this thing happen, which would be well, okay, that's not so bad.
the thing is that from the point of view of Venezuelan society and in Nicaraguan society, all those deaths just create deep division and enduring
right.
hatreds that are very difficult to overcome.
Of course,
that's the whole point.
Exactly.
So to create this political polarization that facilitates the U.S. Agenda in the region.
Yeah, I mean, I was being glib, of course. And what happens here is you have the United States going into countries where everyone involved, allies, enemies, whatever, are expendable, and they'll burn them up in order, at the bottom, the United Fruit or somebody else can make an extra $12 next year.
Yeah, so, and I think that's right, and of course. And then the other aspect in relation to what happened in Ivory Coast that you mentioned just now is, of course, the Lima group of countries, which is a group of right-wing countries who are unable to force through their agenda in the OAS because they didn't have enough support to invoke the OAS democratic charter
right.
against Venezuela. They set up all of those right-wing countries that failed to get their way in the OAS democratically. They set up this Lima group, which originally included Mexico, but Mexico is kind of putting some distance between
yeah.
its new foreign policy under Andrés Manuel López Obrador
yep.
and the policy of the previous president Peña Nieto, and Mexico no longer supports the pronouncements of the Lima group against Venezuela. But what the Lima group is doing is, and remember that one's talking about a group of presidents who have zero moral authority to criticize anybody. People like Mauricio Macri and Jair Bolsonaro, for example, or Sebastian Piñera in Chile. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to pave the way for an indictment in the International Criminal Court against President Nicolas Maduro on the absurd grounds of crimes against humanity, which is exactly
right.
what happened to Laurent Gbagbo.
Right, that's right.
The Ivory Coast president, who was sent off to the International Courts, prisons in what's the name of that place in Holland, Scheveningen.
Right.
And they after 8 years, the prosecutor, the International Court Criminal Court prosecutor, completely failed to put up a case.
Right.
And then, as you and I were saying just before we started talking, the court eventually felt bound to exonerate and acquit.
Right.
Laurent Gbagbo and his Charles Blay Goudé, his former education or youth minister, who was also
right.
on
That's
charged
right.
With Gbagbo.
Right.
But then immediately, what happened was that the prosecutor refused to be outdone, immediately appealed, had that first appeal rejected by the court that acquitted Gbagbo, and then put in another appeal that the court felt bound to accept. So
right.
Gbagbo is still in jail.
Right, and this is, they carted him out of the presidential palace. Again, to me, it's, you know, 1,000 years from now, when students are studying the age of imperialism as some, you know, aberration in human history, When there's a chapter that discusses it with deep humility, I'm imagining that the photograph that is on the cover of that chapter is going to be the French army with UN troops taking Laurent Gbagbo out of the presidential palace after he was reelected at gunpoint to take him to this court where he sat for almost 9 years, only to be acquitted and is still being held while process goes on, instead of at least being released on bail after all this time.
Right. And of course, that's what the Lima group want to do with Nicolas Maduro. It's the same scenario that people like Lula da Silva and Jorge Glass, the former vice president of Ecuador, and associates of former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. And it's that kind of bogus legal procedure.
What do you do with a Martin Luther King or with Mandela? Or what? Where do they do their best work? In prison. Why? Because they end up in prison a lot. Because that's the response from power.
Right. So, and so that's what the Lima Group have in mind for Nicolas Maduro. And the reason I mention that is because one has to look at what's happening in Venezuela, and with taking into account everything that's happening. And the incident that happened over the weekend with these guys stealing arms and trying to start an army mutiny, the economic sanctions, the recognition of the legislature in Venezuela by the U.S. government as Venezuela's legitimate authority, these attempts by the Lima group to prepare an indictment against Nicolas Maduro in the International Criminal Court. They're all part of the same thing. It's just regime change, right, without, at the moment, or to date, U.S. military intervention.
Right.
But that's going to be the next stage, because none of it's working.
Well, they're getting ready also. If you look at... I'm looking at an article in Granma, you know, the Cuban newspaper, and they're talking about how it was last week, I guess, the 16th, the U.S. State Department announced that they were suspending for a month and a half Title III of Helms-Burton. Remember Helms-Burton? It puts in the incredible regime of sanctions in the history of mankind. In essence, their problem is they're looking to figure out a way to intensify the pressure on Cuba based on its, quote, indefensible support for increasingly authoritarian, corrupt regimes in Venezuela and Nicaragua. In other words, they're looking to completely break up any support whatsoever, any solidarity among independent nations in Latin America through Helms-Burton.
Yeah, and of course, implicitly, they're trying to destroy ALBA, which was the motor of Latin American and Caribbean integration, between, let's say, 2008 and the death of Hugo Chavez in 2013.
Well, it's been
that's what it's all about. But and I don't think we should be too, you know, and things are very adverse at the moment. But that it's not the first time things have been adverse. We just have to think back to 2004 when the idea of ALBA was broached by Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. And things were extremely adverse back then. So there's nothing really new in the current situation except that it seems more intense and more urgent.
No, it's ebb and flow. Look, in my opinion, you know, I'm with Marx, Engels, Lenin, you know, eventually we win. I'm assuming this is something they didn't know about, atomic weapons. I'm assuming that we're not a pile of, you know, a heaping pile of steaming ash. And if that's the case, at some point, we do win. But they've done a pretty impressive job of messing up things that were coming into fruition, having picked Brazil out of the BRICS by decapitation. And also, but they're looking at the bottom at dismantling ALBA. That's what I'm saying. The attack is multidimensional.
Right. So and it's not going. They're not getting things all their own way, because they themselves are caught up in the contradictions of the allies that they've chosen. I mean, when I say they, I mean the United States elites.
Right.
And they've chosen. And look at Brazil. And Bolsonaro's barely been in office for a month. I don't think he's even been in office for a month.
No, he hasn't.
And he's gone off to Davos to kind of spout nonsense about how private investment is going to dramatically improve Brazil's economy.
Yeah.
Well, where have we heard that before? Well, of course, why not Argentina? Even the IMF boss, whose name I've forgotten now, that French woman.
Yeah.
Even she acknowledges that Argentina is a basket case.
Lagarde.
Despite her assistance. So, and what's happening in Brazil at the moment is that while Bolsonaro is spouting his kind of insane nonsense in Davos, his son is being investigated for corruption by the Brazilian authorities. Why is that happening? Because the Brazilian elites have decided that Bolsonaro is, even after a month, Bolsonaro is no longer as useful, any use to them.
Right.
And they're going to try and do something else over the next year or so.
His actual, his use, the real use to that he spent when he won the election. His job was to make sure that Lula did not get elected president from prison or whatever, or his Lula's agent. Once they got past that, this guy on the slag heap, he thinks, this is the mistake, we mentioned this earlier, this is the mistake that fascists often make, or severe right-wing, quote-unquote, populists, and that is that they think it's about them instead of understanding that it's about the same power that existed before you that has you as its face right now, and you can either make them happy and get paid well, or end up on the slag heap and see the next one rise.
Yeah, and even the Brazilian military, who of course are important players, of course, in Brazil's economy, and they're now contradicting Bolsonaro's initial willingness to host U.S. military bases in Brazil. But the Brazilian military is saying they don't want that now.
Right, we are very independent.
You know, and that's just one that's just one example of all kinds of contradictions that we should talk about maybe another time.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. I keep dragging it off the track today. Go ahead, because we've got about 10 minutes left and we have a lot of ground to cover, and I want to make sure we do.
Yeah, so I'm looking again at that point that and things aren't the United States elites and the governments that they've bought there in the United States, and they're not getting things all their own way. And in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador continues to be extremely popular, and they had that terrible oil pipeline explosion with. I think the death toll now is over 90, with hundreds injured, that were a direct result of something that he's been trying to work against in the short time that he's been president, namely corruption in the Mexico's oil industry, and that is what led to that explosion.
Right.
And his response to that terrible humanitarian disaster has been exemplary.
Right.
And so, you know, and you can see in Mexico that they have somebody there that, and however his politics are going to pan out internally, his profile is one that fits the image of the populist leader that doesn't do what the United States wants.
Right.
So, and Mexico's what, the second most important economy in Latin America after Brazil, and I think so.
Yeah.
So that is going against U.S. plans in the region. Nicaragua so far has resisted U.S. attempts to make it do what the United States wants, and that's likely to continue to be the case. So we can expect to see in Nicaragua events will follow a similar pattern to what we've seen in Venezuela ever since 2013.
Right.
But the thing is that it'll be very difficult for the United States to undercut support for the government of President Daniel Ortega. Because unless they apply economic sanctions, in the way that they have against Venezuela. But and I think that they'll find that harder to do in Nicaragua's case, paradoxically.
I think so too, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've got, first of all, they may end up doing sort of what Obama did with Russia and China. Especially as they reach a number of these countries, like, let's say, you know, as it becomes more and more evident that this is a movement against simultaneously Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Bolivia, and then yanking on the left flank, say, of Mexico and some other places, you may see that you've driven everyone into each other's arms to embrace China. And because China has already been up and down, and this might flip them yet again and see the canal being built like next Tuesday.
Yeah, and in general, I'm looking at the region, it is only a question of time before people react against the governments that are not responding to their to ordinary people's interests. And I don't like using that phrase, ordinary people, but I'm certainly let's talk about impoverished majorities. Their needs are not going to be met by these right-wing governments. And you can see that even in Ecuador, where Lenin Moreno turned out to be a total quisling, a total traitor in terms of how he came to power. He came to power on the back of Rafael Correa's successful management of a very difficult period in Ecuador's economic development. And then he blamed the subsequent problems that his policies have begun to generate. He's now blaming that on Rafael Correa, and he's also engaging, and he's entered into an alliance with the very right-wing parties that he was campaigning against during the presidential election campaign. So, and his policies are turning out to be as disastrous as those of Macri in Argentina, and as we'll see shortly in Brazil, Bolsonaro's in Brazil. Yeah. So, and people are not going to put up with that. And so the question is, how far is the United States, are the United States elites and the government they control prepared to go with their regional allies engaging in the kinds of repressive policies that they used in the past? Because that's the only way they're going to stop progressive governments again taking power, or at least taking office, in Latin America and the Caribbean.
And the question also was, how far can they go? Because, you know, we were mentioning how everything's going in the direction of the United States' interest. Now let's look at the other side of this. You've got in Guatemala and Honduras, people are in the streets against, you know, the Jimmy Morales in Guatemala and Hernandez in Honduras. These, you know, the U.S.-backed. You got Fujimori going back to jail in Peru, and Milagro Sala looking at 12 years and conspiracy charges in Argentina. So back and forth, back and forth. The murders by paramilitary in Chile. You know, there's an awful lot of churn coming from both sides that's going on. You know, people may end up in jail that think they're going to be president.
Well, yeah, and also, you mentioned Guatemala. And what's going on in Guatemala is that what you'd think would be a right-wing government supported by the United States is actually in conflict with United States policies in the region because they refuse to accept external interference in their internal affairs via the UN's anti-corruption and impunity body.
Right.
That is in conflict with the Guatemalan elites that Morales represents.
Right.
So, you know, and we're going to see that repeatedly. And I think we've talked about this a little bit in the past, Dom, how the internal contradictions within even the right-wing elites eventually are going to make it impossible for the United States to sustain the policies that it's taken for granted over, what, the last century?
No, or two, just, yeah. It's the same thing. We discussed this with respect to Nicaragua, for example. The distinction between the domestic bourgeoisie and, you know, the Quisling, you know, international, I don't know if you'd call them bourgeoisie at the local level. They're more like hirelings almost, they're crackers.
Right.
But in other words, you know, you'd have before a local bourgeoisie that wants to own a chain of bodegas, for example, as an expression of their newfound wealth, and they're glad to sell out all of the nickel or copper or whatever of the country in order to have that position. But now you have, at this stage of development of these countries, some people who are actual players and international markets where they can go out themselves as wealthy individuals and be players, you know, globally. Well, you're from the United States and coming into my country, you ain't telling me what to do. And you have those kind of conflicts even in the military, which is, they should have known this because Brazil's always been like this. You're not going to send in an AFRICOM type, officer corps into Brazil and have them direct the Brazilian military. The Brazilians will shoot them themselves.
Right. And those kinds of contradictions we'll also see in the presidential elections upcoming in El Salvador.
Yeah.
The same kinds of contradictions are at work there, and where it's currently a three-way race between the government party, the FMLN, the right-wing opposition party, ARENA, and a newer party that's kind of centre-right called GANA, that's led by a former FMLN mayor called Bukele. And there's a catfight going on among the El Salvadoran right-wing elites about, you know, who's best going to represent their corrupt interests, and because it looks as though those elections will go to a runoff, and that is likely to be won by Bukele at the moment.
In the second round.
That might change. Who knows?
Yeah, that kind of a process, and we're out of time already, but I mean, that kind of a process shows you that the internal conditions are in flux. And they're attempting to find some accommodation to that condition to, you know, adjust things to the new reality. Tony, we're out of time, and we'll pick this up next week. Lots to talk about and lots to keep track of, for sure.
Sure. Thanks a million, Don.
Thank you, too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Another Russiagate bombshell fizzles. This time it was BuzzFeed. This prompted The Intercept to write Beyond BuzzFeed, the 10 worst, most embarrassing U.S. media failures on the Trump-Russia story. Has hatred for Trump destroyed the profession of journalism? Crosstalking the Media, I'm joined by my guest, Tim Black, in Washington. He's a political analyst, commentator, and host of The Tim Black Show. And in Fort Lauderdale, we cross to John Cardillo. He is host of America Talks Live on Newsmax TV. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Tim, let me go to you in Washington. When I heard the BuzzFeed story break, I just waited for it to be debunked, like all the other ones. And we could spend the entire program and then some listing each individual one and who did it and why it fell apart. And so I was very gleeful that it was debunked because it was a short amount of time and that Mueller did it on top of that there. And then watching cable primarily, the more liberal stations tried to explain it. And on CNN, we got this from Jeffrey Toobin on a panel. The larger message that a lot of people are going to take from this story is that the news media are a bunch of leftist liars who are dying to get the president, and they're willing to lie to do it. And I don't think that is true. Well, when he said that, I said, well, Jeffrey Toobin, you're right. And I've been saying that for 2 years. And the question is, and I said in my introduction, is just the hatred of Trump made journalism dysfunctional, almost irrelevant now? Go ahead, Tim, in Washington.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I agree. First of all, thank you for having me, Peter. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
And yes, you're right. Jeffrey Toobin, he said a true statement. That was a very true. What he just said was not fake news. He's absolutely right that they are disintegrating the public trust. In fact, it seems like more of a race to the bottom of public trust every time one of these stories comes out, Peter. I remember a great poet, the late, great Maya Angelou. She said, when people show you who they are, believe them. And people are starting to believe that the media, the corporate media, is pretty much full of it, Peter, and they're starting to lose trust in it.
Okay.
And I understand exactly where that comes from.
You know, let me go to John in Fort Lauderdale. This is Chris Cuomo on CNN about the BuzzFeed debacle. Quote, Mueller didn't do the media any favors tonight, and he did do one for the president. Now, I mean, if that doesn't show his open bias right there, I mean, the thing is, I look at this and I look at it only as an exercise, and I don't watch very much of it because it's very, very repetitive. It's not fact based, and it is a lot of it is just ideological platitudes. But he's actually showing what CNN and MSNBC and others are like. There's no self-reflection, is there, about their behavior and how they see the world? Go ahead, John, in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, no, you know, look, anybody who's going to worry about what Fredo, Chris Cuomo, thinks is out of their mind anyway. But what he said is part of a bigger problem, a larger problem, right? It underscores it. Cuomo and the rest of his buddies over at CNN, Brian Stelter, the MSNBC crew, they automatically assume that anyone who is even perceived to be anti-Trump is their ally. Yeah. There was this expectation that Robert Mueller was going to do their bidding by implying that maybe there was some weight to the BuzzFeed story, which was not to look to anonymous sources. Then, as you know, Peter Carr, Mueller's spokesman, comes out on the record. He says, there's nothing here. It's completely wrong. Furthermore, Rudy Giuliani, a guy that's been out there beating the hell out of Mueller and his team, agrees with them one time and says, look, I've spoken to Mueller's team, as have the president's outside attorneys, the other outside attorneys. We all agree there's nothing there. BuzzFeed got it completely wrong. The mainstream media, by the way, still can't bring themselves to admit BuzzFeed was wrong. They've got the reporters on, and the reporters are saying, well, our reporting will bear out to be true. Well, maybe it was misconstrued, but we don't really know what Mueller knows. Maybe his spokesman is doing a deflection to throw Trump off. The problem with the mainstream media and why Jeffrey Toobin was right, even though he was doing it in a backhanded way, is time again, time after time, they discredit themselves. And this week was a great week for them. They had the BuzzFeed story and then this Native American guy attacking those kids. They were debunked within minutes. I started on the BuzzFeed story early, about 10 minutes after it dropped. I even wound up getting a retweet from President Trump when I said, I told you all the BuzzFeed story was nonsense. I mean, this is so transparent. But isn't it sad that we're at a place where we have to doubt the media? Yeah. We have to doubt every left-leaning journalist as to whether or not they look. It's not even if their sources are accurate, Peter, Tim. It's if the sources even exist.
Yeah, you know, let me go back to Tim. You know,
right,
Tim. You know, I mean, I don't know how many of these bombshells have fizzled. A few dozen at the very least here. They always drop in one direction, though, don't they? It's never been the other side. And so I'm willing to allow, and because I work in media, I can understand when an outlet makes a mistake and then you come around and say, we got our facts wrong, we apologize to our audience, and I'm going to be more careful. But it's always in one direction, and there's hard, I mean, then they take it off the internet, they try to delete it everywhere, and then they don't learn from it. They're just looking for the same mistake to be made again because it's their do it with such ideological glee. And this is, Tim, this is what's getting them in trouble. They're ideologically blind because of their hatred. Now, I am a conservative. I don't like everything Donald Trump does. And I do criticize Donald Trump, but I do it based on facts, okay? Not because of my ideological tilt. Go ahead, Tim.
You're right. It does appear to be just coming from one direction, the false stories or the stories that don't exactly pan out to be what they claim to be. It's sort of like a misrepresentation of buying a vehicle, and you think it's a good vehicle. You take it home, you find out it's a lemon. And part of that is not so much about the liberal or the conservative angle. I think it's more about profits. And, you know, in 2016, CNN made an extra $10 million, Peter, John, $10 million on their Trump coverage. And then they went on the second presidential debate. They sold ad rates were 40 times more than what they usually would sell. So you put two and two together, you get four, and what you get is a media that's focused on profit, not focused on accuracy.
That's very true. I mean, Trump is a good brand for the liberal media. Okay, but I can understand the bottom line. I don't have a problem with that per se. Okay, but what I do have a problem is debasing journalistic principles, because we have fake news. Okay, all right, that came out as a result of the election. But now we have something that is like acceptable fake news if it is applicable to your ideological goal. Go ahead, John.
Well, look, now, Tim's spot on, right? This is all about profits. It costs a cable operation millions of dollars a month to be carried on the major cable operators. If you're just cable, forget broadcast, right? To be carried on a Comcast, DirecTV, Dish, you're spending millions of dollars a month. Well, you need to create theater. Straight down the middle news is no longer that profitable. It's not going to sustain those millions a month in carriage fees. It's not going to sustain the production teams you need to go out and do the research. So all of these outlets are playing to their own echo chamber. We've come to accept that. And I think the smart consumers of news get it. But there's still an expectation of honesty. Like you, Peter, I admit, I'm a conservative commentator, but I bring people facts, statistics, data. I look at it through my bent. If I bring up FBI data about, you know, black on black crime, sure, the left is going to hammer me and say, well, those numbers are accurate, but there are societal and sociological causes for it. Fair. That's a legitimate debate. Right. But I've had commentators on the left say, well, those FBI numbers are lies because the FBI and law enforcement is corrupt and they lied about those numbers. You can't debate from that position because it's a fallacy from the outset. So it's fine to me anyway, if somebody has a political bent. We know CNN and MSNBC are left. That's fine. Present your data through that lens, but at least do it honestly. That's what's lacking.
Well, okay, Tim's right. Well, that's the point, John. Let me go back to Tim here. I mean, honesty is the point here. I mean, because they're transparently not honest. Okay. We saw that with this story, with BuzzFeed. And what really bothers me is that I don't have a problem wearing your politics on your sleeve. That's fine. As a matter of fact, I actually respect people that do that. Okay.
Right.
But Tim, I mean, just claiming that, you know, they are down the middle and we're neutral and we're fair. I mean, that is just being intellectually and morally dishonest, Tim.
Yeah, like I stated before, Peter, I just believe it's a factor of economics. I mean, if you really want to get to the crux of the matter, you got to go back to 1996. Jump in your time machine, stop Bill Clinton for passing the Telecommunications Act that allowed, five networks, now it's five, it used to be six, to own 90% of our media. So that's where the problem lies. There's no diversity in the coverage, and people have to play to an audience. And I think that's really what the culprit is. I don't think that the folks at MSNBC care too much about bashing Trump. They don't dislike Trump. They just love the money from Trump. Remember when Obama was in office and we heard all this talk about Obama's tan suit? I mean, they talked about that like it was big news. Then they were debating if Dijon mustard on Obama's hamburgers meant he was American enough. You know, the Dijon mustard, that didn't work because Hillary said you gotta have hot sauce, Peter. So, like, look, this was the whole thing with Obama, you know? So it doesn't matter who's in office, but the angle that they've chosen with Donald Trump is negativity. And that's the problem. As to John's point, it's not about the substance of the policies. I like policy debates, guys. They debate about Trump's personality, and that's just not going to win many votes.
Exactly.
That's it, right? He eats a well-done steak, ergo he's a Russian spy. I mean, the connections they make are simply asinine and bizarre.
Yeah. Well, because he should have never been president, and they still can't get over it. So they find
that's it, Peter.
Oh, you know, I mean, it was those Cuban crickets. You know, they were being run by Vladimir Putin in Cuba. You know, and people believe that. They believe that kind of stuff. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on media. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to John in Fort Lauderdale. I agree with in the first part of the program, we were talking about the bottom line, and you know, Trump is a good money machine. You know, hate Trump and you can make money. But I think there's more breadth to this here, and I think that we see the cultural divide come out so much on cable, and it's so condescending. I mean, you know, Trump went through, you know, the real estate wars and the tabloid wars in New York. I mean, he's got a really thick skin. Okay, fine. Okay, I don't agree with everything he says. I don't agree with everything that he does. Okay, however, the way the media treats supporters of the president, I find quite disgusting, to be honest with you. It's demeaning, it's condescending, and they show that they're morally superior. And that's what really gets on my nerves when I watch MSNBC and CNN. Go ahead, John, in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, look, that's exactly it. I mean, we have a nation of 330 million people, right? 2,500 counties in the United States. But if you look at where news is created, it's New York, Washington, D.C., to an extent, Chicago with the advertising agencies, Los Angeles with media, and in the hot season, South Florida, Palm Beach and Miami. All liberal hotbeds, but more importantly, Peter, it's the same people. They just move around depending on where it's cool to be. So you've got a handful of people in the grand context of the population of the United States in these four or five places that all have contempt for what's called, flyover country, right? So they look at the 63 million Americans who voted for Trump as these troglodytes, these Neanderthals who you know, just want to go out there and shoot anything that moves. And they hate people of color, and they hate Jews, and they hate Muslims, and they're uneducated and ignorant because these elitists, this handful of elitists in the ad agencies, the newsrooms, these editorial directors, news directors, they all go to the same cocktail parties. They all go to the same dinner parties, and they mock the rest of the nation, when in reality, the rest of the nation is as educated. They make very good money, and they're commonsensical. They see through this nonsense. Well, look, the media elite with a grasp on the message can't have people seeing through the veneer. So what do? Well, they're terrified. They're nervous wrecks. So they resort to ad hominem attacks. They try to insult them and degrade them so that other people will want to move away from them and hang out with the cool kids at the New York, D.C., L.A. cocktail parties. The Internet has been an amazing tool to smash that veneer, right? Because now there's so much content. And they're debunked in real time. If the Internet didn't exist, that BuzzFeed story would have been taken as truth and used in impeachment proceedings. The mainstream media is hysterical, Peter. They're hysterical. They can no longer send out the message they want to send. They're debunked in real time. The truth is getting out there. But it's what you say. They have contempt and disrespect for mainstream America, and mainstream America is rebelling.
You know, Tim, in Washington, they just don't understand half of the country. They simply are out of touch with it. And I think the most important thing that probably happened, other than what was done to Bernie Sanders, was that one speech that Hillary Clinton made, is the deplorables. And I think that energized. I knew a lot of people in the U.S. during the summer leading up to the election, and that was what I kept hearing over and over again. Did you hear what she called us? And the media echo that. The media they call conservatives and members of the Republican Party, that they use a dog whistle all the time when it comes to like issues of race. But when I watch CNN and MSNBC, they are the dog whistle. It's over and over and over again. They're the one that plays this. They're the ones that divide people. And this identity politics is just on steroids, which most of the country, well, at least probably half of it, I understand it, but I don't agree with it. And I think it's condescending to individuality and personal choices. OK, they know nothing about me, but because of what I look like, They know everything, apparently. I think that's the definition of Jim Crow itself. Go ahead, Tim, in Washington.
Well, yeah, you know, you're going to see this happen right as we move into 2020, where people are looking at people like Kamala Harris as if they're going to be the new coming of Obama. And to me, she is just more platitudes and more identity politics. See, look, I don't care what color a candidate is or a politician is. What I care about is, are the policies actually going to be effective? And to make a long story short, there really is no policy points that are directed towards the people. But they give us these platitudes like that they're talking to black folks or talking to gays and talking to Latinos to a lesser extent, but where is the substance in the policy that will actually benefit these people? See, that's where we have a problem with identity politics, is they use it as a mechanism to attract the voters, because we know that the black population are the most loyal voters in America. They vote 90% for the Democratic Party, but what do they get out of the
what
party?
What did they
that's
get?
That's one of my objectives.
What did they get? What did
nothing.
They get out of it?
And that's...
No,
that's
because you be because you'll be a traitor. You'll be a traitor if you decide on your own. You must go with the pack, okay? Or you're a traitor to your party that's done, quote unquote, so much for you, okay? Let me go to John. The stories about Trump are just endless, okay? I mean, by the time we get done, check Twitter, I'm sure there's a new one. But remember when Trump was, he had a football team at the White House, and he ordered out fast food, which I thought was hysterical. I thought it was funny. I liked the pictures. I thought it was a nice touch. I mean, for Donald Trump, it was a nice touch. And then he talked about salads.
What?
And then for like a half a news site, he's a sexist because he said his wife might be able to fix him up a salad. I mean, I don't understand why. I mean, they spent hour after hour talking about that kind of thing. That doesn't better people's lives. All it does is shove down an ideology down people's throat, and it's just a form of virtue signaling, which doesn't pay for a meal, okay? It doesn't. Go ahead, John.
Well, look, but that incident, right, with the Clemson Tigers at the White House shows how out of touch the media is with America. Most of America likes fast food. They like burgers. And how out of touch are they to think that a bunch of high school football players would be offended that they had burgers with their billionaire president who used to hook up with porn stars? I mean, these guys were loving every minute of it. And that shows you how out of touch the mainstream media is. Right? I mean, these people have no idea how normal Americans live, how normal alpha males in their 20s who just won the NCAA football title want to act and where they want to be. The players loved every minute of it. America found it endearing and down to earth. And it was a really good moment for the president, for the White House, for the team. But a bunch of soy boy beta male elitists got all in a tizzy because the nutrition, the calorie count wasn't properly labeled on the burger. And oh my God, he might have gotten Chick-fil-A. And oh, he's a misogynist, racist, xenophobic. Oh. I mean, this, it's so ridiculous that we're laughing at them.
No.
But so
I just think if someone's in an airport and they see this program being broadcast, we will trigger someone. Someone will be triggered watching this program. Tim, I don't know
guys,
if you were agreeing
the
or disagreeing.
The fast food was cold.
Go ahead.
It was cold. It was cold fast food. Who wants cold fast food, Peter? Come on, John. You don't want a cold burger. Who wants cold fries? There's nothing worse than cold fries, man. No one was happy about that.
No.
They got invited
I'm sure,
to go to Mike Stranahan's
Tim,
house
I'm
for
sure,
lobster rolls.
I'm sure there was a CNN correspondent there, and their hair was on fire, and it warmed up the burgers, okay? Don't worry about it, okay? These are tough guys, all right? These are tough guys. Okay, Tim, more seriously, what is the state of journalism? Because it looks like it's just advocacy. That's really what it is. They're lobbyists. Okay, some of them have a pretty face. Some of them can read an auto cue. Some can even ask some questions. But I mean, I don't see any real quality coming out. As a matter of fact, I just see stenographers for power way too often. Go ahead.
Well, you know what? Thank you, Peter. You know, George Orwell once said that journalism writes what someone doesn't want you to print, right? So that would be the case. But A, he didn't mean you could make it up as you go along. B, he didn't mean you could invent sources. Oh, let's invent anonymous sources. And C, he didn't mean for them to try to make money off of Donald Trump and forget all the facts. So, yes, you know, journalism is taking a big hit right now. And I blame, yes, I blame the liberal media and the corporate media, but I'm looking at Fox News, too, and I'm wondering, are they just trying to balance it? I mean, come on, Fox News is the most successful news program. CNN and MSNBC got their pockets turned inside out with cups in their hands. I mean, they're really killing it.
You know,
so I think it's all across the board. Yeah. We have the same problem.
I mean, let me add something.
Hang on, Jim. I'm going to just say, in fairness, you know, Tucker Carlson is not exactly the same as Hannity and Laura, okay, Ingram, okay? I see that they do have a balance there. I mean, those are the three programs that I watch at Fox, so it does cover a lot of area. Go ahead, John, in Fort Lauderdale.
No, it does, and I agree with both of you, but here's the other issue, right? Even Fox is missing something. On Fox's best night, barring debates, they get about 5 million viewers. Well, 63 million people voted for Donald Trump. What are the other 58 million people watching? That's a question I ask myself every day. And what content do those other 58 million people, over 90% of the Trump voters that aren't watching Fox News on its best night, where are they? What are they watching? And what are the current networks, the current cable outlets, the broadcast outlets lacking that's preventing or causing those 58 million people
to not watch? I think I have an answer to that. I think a lot of people, more and more so, people are watching podcasts on YouTube. But look at the hits, you know, your program. And, you know, it's alternative, like Tim and John, both of you here. And Crosstalk, too, as well. We do pretty well. People are being turned off by this corporate message that is ideologically directed in one direction here. Last few seconds, go to Tim. Go ahead. 30 seconds, go to you.
Peter, they're also watching their paychecks. They're watching their bank accounts get smaller and smaller. They're watching their jobs get sent overseas. That also motivated those voters, not just what they watched on the news.
Okay, gentlemen, that's almost we've run out of time here. But one thing is for sure, the way what Russiagate has done to journalism, I have to wonder if it's ever going to recover. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Fort Lauderdale. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.